Thank you so much, Sharon. And while I have Jenny here, and thank you, you've been so helpful on that, she's going to try and adjust the mic. So tell me, can you hear me at this point? So I'll try to keep this voice going as long as possible. I lost my voice because my sister Martha made me talk all the way to Holden Lake and back again yesterday. And I should have known better. When I get colds, I get laryngitis afterwards. But I'm actually going to ask Martha if she would do an opening prayer for us, which we've already sung before. We're just going to hear it now. This is God Bless the World We Love, which you'll need to project. Actually, here.
God bless the world we love, stranger and friend. Go before us, restore us, with a hope that despair cannot end. Every people, every nation, mighty ocean, heaven's dome. God bless the world we love, our fragile home. God bless the world you love, our fragile home.
I wanted to start with that. Is it still working okay? I wanted to start with that just to remind ourselves that we're talking about really difficult issues. And the reason we're talking about them is because we love this home that we call Earth. And we love our communities on it. And Earth is imperiled, but it's not without hope. And so the issues we're talking about are really challenging. And I've mentioned this before. I teach in the environmental studies program at the University of Montana, and we're sometimes accused of being the most depressing major on campus. And it really is a teaching challenge because we have to do two things simultaneously. And my wonderful former student Rebecca, who's somewhere in the room, where are you, Rebecca? I keep picking on you, but she can tell you whether or not we're actually doing this. We have to both educate our students about the really sobering realities that we are facing as a planet, but not inculcate despair. To actually educate in such a way as to motivate us, to give us agency to address these issues while there still is time. And I wouldn't be doing this work if I didn't believe there is still time. But time is short, it's urgent, and so we need to figure out how to talk to each other. And as Peter was talking about this morning, move beyond talking to each other. And as Alan's been talking to us about, how do we then act on these convictions here? Today is the first of three case studies. I put on the board here, and I realize for some of you it'll be harder to see these here, but just to remind us where we've been. The first two sessions are trying to help orient us to the big picture about thinking about environmental or ecological or social issues. And there's a range of questions that ethicists asked us to think about as we do this. So as I mentioned before, the first and one of the primary ones that's emerged in our time is who or what belongs to our moral community. What I mean by that is who or what has what we call moral status. That would be things that have value for their own right, and they make claims on us that we have to treat them with some respect because they have moral stature. And so we talked about how that's expanded over time in the human community, where we may have started initially only with our families, then perhaps our clan, eventually might have gotten to our nation state. Now, most people believe that all human beings have moral status. They have moral value and need to have rights and need to be respected. The environmental crisis has made us ask that question again: do we limit our moral community to human beings? Or are there other beings or even ecosystems, things outside that have moral value that we need, that make claims on us, that we have to think about when we act in the world? And so there's a whole spectrum of responses. On one side, pure anthropocentrism would say only human beings have value, everything about intrinsic value, value for their own sake. Everything else has value for us in terms of how we use it. It might mean we still have to use them prudently, wisely, but we can use them as resources, not worry about them for their own sake. On the far other side is a position of biocentrism, and the far right of that one would be, or far side of it would be, we call biocentric egalitarianism, the claim that all of life has value and it's equal intrinsic value. And I would say many of us were probably somewhere in between that. For example, those of us who have companion animals, dogs, cats, horses, so forth, who are important parts of our lives, know that they make claims on us. We have a duty or responsibility to treat them well, to take care of them when they get sick, They can provide for their food and so forth. So if that's part of where you are, you've moved partway at least upon motion here. Other of us would say, well, wild animals, while they're not companion animals, they have rights and that we need to respect. We need to make sure that they have the habitat they need. So we actually have an Endangered Species Act that says when a wild animal's species numbers get so low, we have to protect their habitat so they can thrive in that. Some people are raising these questions about our animals that we use for food and clothing, domesticated animals. Do we have duties and responsibilities? Some people are moving beyond individual animals and talking about whole ecosystems. I'll give you an example. I lived and taught for 10 years in Iowa, which was a really enriching experience. But Iowa is home to one of the most endangered ecosystems in the world, which is the tall grass prairie. The tall grass prairie produces incredibly fertile soil. So almost all of Iowa's tall grass prairie has been converted to agriculture, and we are the better off as a human species as a result of that. But that's taken a huge toll on the tall grass prairie as an ecosystem and the animals and plants that used to inhabit that. So do we even need to rethink about our relationship to ecosystems? All sorts of different things start coming up. So that's kind of a foundational discussion. We've been practicing thinking about that. A second one that has been a long-standing question, at least in the Western tradition, but I think in almost every society, is how do we balance the tension between focusing on individuals and what individuals need and focusing on communities or the whole well-being of societies? And when you move that into an ecological context, it can expand to think about, do we focus on individual animals and or individual plants or trees and their moral status, or do we put more attention on ecosystems? And people said yesterday, and I agree with this, to some extent this is a false dichotomy. Many of us think that both are really important. But there are times when we have to make decisions about them. So one example might be horses and burros were introduced to this country. They become wild in many parts of the West. And as a result of that, they've had tremendous damage on ecosystems. Or some of you live in Texas or the Southwest, and you know what introduced pigs have done. Feral pigs now in these places, a place like Hawaii. Do we eliminate them so we protect their ecosystems? Or do we say, no, they are creatures in their own right with moral status. They bear no responsibility that we introduce them. Or do we find some compromise in between? But these are the really difficult, is when we get down to actual policy decisions, how do we think about this? And then the last one we talked about a little bit is what's the vision that guides us? How do we understand our current situation? And is our current situation sufficient to be able to address these issues? Some people would argue that our current system is just fine, and I would call that a kind of a status quo position. Other people say our current system has problems, but we can reform it. So a free market economy, a democratic society, those things have within them the ability for us to address these issues, but they need significant reform. And there are others who say, no, our systems and cultures are the problem themselves. A free market economy that depends on ever-growing levels of consumption is simply incompatible with a planet with ecological limits. A society that puts a strong emphasis on individual rights is incompatible when increasingly we have to think about the whole well-being. A religious tradition that has had a strong teaching on dominion or even being stewards over the earth is problematic when we have to start thinking ecologically. And I'm not arguing in favor against those. I'm simply saying those are some of the questions that get raised there. So these broad framing issues can help us to locate ourselves in the midst of some other really difficult issues. And today we're going to look at the intersection of three challenging issues that confront us at the planetary level today. One of those is human population growth. So I mentioned when my grandparents were married in the early 1900s, the population of the globe was about 1.6 billion. By the time they died at the end of the 20th century, my great-aunt Virginia is a good example. She was born in 1900, died in 1998. She lived almost entirely within the 20th century. When she was born, the population was 1.6 billion. When she died, it was 6.1 billion. It had quadrupled within the 20th century. Since that time, we've added another 1.5 billion people, currently about 7.5 billion. So that has tremendous implications for both social and environmental ecological issues. A second thing is the rate of consumption, how much we actually consume. While population has quadrupled or even quintupled in the last century and a half, our levels of consumption have grown much more rapidly. Many of us now consume 30 times as much as people would have a century and a half ago, an entire society. So our levels of consumption, and what we've seen over and over is with rising affluence comes rising levels of consumption. So that's a whole other issue. So we'll see, for example, that a child born in Bangladesh over the course of her lifetime will consume 1/32nd as much resources as a child born in the United States. So my grandson, who's about 3.5 now, will likely consume 30 to 40 times as much as a similar boy that age in Bangladesh or Haiti or those places there. So consumption is another element. And then the big elephant in the room for all of this is climate change. That both human population growth and rising consumption levels exacerbate, if not feed or force, the use of the greenhouse gas emissions that are causing climate change here that has an impact on virtually every other issue. So what we'll see in the case, let me just a quick show of hands. How many of you had a chance to read through at least part of the case for today? A lot of you. That's wonderful. That's great. And if you didn't, don't worry about it. I'm going to try and summarize it a little bit here. But the case revolves around a young man named Greg, who's part of a couple with his fiancée, Sarah. And he has become very good friends with a young woman named Samira, who is from Nigeria. And the International Student Association at the college where they go has asked to put a forum together. They want basically one person from each of 5 different continents. I mean, from North America, from Europe, from Asia, from Africa, South America. And they asked them to address the intersection of population growth, consumption, and climate change, but to address both the structural dimensions, the large social dimensions, but also to speak personally about it. And what it's done is it's forced Greg to start having conversations with his fiance about starting a family and how many children, if any, they want. And Greg is wrestling with the dimension about whether it's not, it's an ethical option to have more than one child in society today here. And this is a really interesting issue. I think many of us in the room here are probably beyond our childbearing years. We're not having to think about those issues anymore. But there are other people in the room who are younger. Many of us have children or grandchildren who are wrestling with this. When I bring this issue up with my students at the University of Montana, some of them are a few years away from having to wrestle with this, but all of them are deeply concerned about their individual impact on these issues there. And so how to address this issue both as a social structural issue about policy issues, but also as an issue of personal responsibility is really deeply powerful and meaningful for them. So what this case does here is it revolves around a conversation, a scenario here, and here are the characters. So Greg's task is to address both the personal and structural dimensions of these 3 issues, population growth, material consumption, and climate change, on this student panel. Greg and Sarah are contemplating starting a family, and a key question for them is how many children to have. So in the course of this case, as they're trying to address, is it ethical for them to have more than one child? They both come from families where they had siblings. That was, for both of them, that was a really important, and continues to be a really important part of their family. So to contemplate having a family with only one sibling, or there's other options of adoption and so forth, has forced them to start thinking about these issues. Sarah responds by initially saying what that's most important is simply, regardless of the number of children they have, to focus on minimizing their family's environmental impact, as a starting point here. Their friend Ingrid says that the big problem with population issue is religion and religious teachings. And we see already, for example, in the very first chapter of the Bible in Genesis, to be fruitful, the command to humans, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Some people who are a little sarcastic about the Bible say it's the only commandment that God's given us that we've done really well. We've been very successful at being fruitful, multiplying, and filling the ends of the earth. But the problem of religion and religious teachings is an issue there. A fellow named John, who was raised by missionaries in Africa, says from his experience, the key to solving population growth is education and empowerment of girls and women. And that should be the focus of any effort to do this here. Samira, who's from Nigeria, argues two things. One is Nigeria is still a largely agricultural society, and agricultural societies depend on large families to do the work. And she says it's hypocritical for wealthy nations that were formerly agricultural societies with large families to now point their finger at poor nations and agricultural societies and large families. She argues that really the issue is poverty. The poverty is in poor nations is driving population growth, but there need to be local solutions that respect their traditions on that. Jacob argues that that human population is much less important than overconsumption in affluent nations. That really the problem lies among wealthy nations and our consumption rates in that. And then Greg's older sister, Anne is a doctoral student in economic development, and she argues that economic growth and development are necessary for poverty reduction, but that needs to be coupled with carbon pricing to try and greenhouse gas emissions. So that's a basic overview. What I'd like to do is to make this an interactive exercise initially, where we actually reconstruct the conversations that Greg is having with his friends here. So I've got here a bunch of chairs. I'm going to sit and be Greg in this chair here. To my left are going to be Samira, Jacob, and Anne. To my right are going to be John, Ingrid, and Sarah. And I'd like to divide you into six groups right now and assign you one of those characters. Have you talked to each other about 5 or 6 minutes to each other about what's the key arguments that that character has? And I put up for convenience, I put the page numbers on there in the case where those characters largely express their views. So you can review those together. And I want you to see if you can understand that person's perspective well enough that one of you can come up here and join me in a conversation about this. It's called a fishbowl experience, if any of you have done fishbowls, although usually we do it in a circle where we face each other. I'm going to have it in an arc so we can talk to each other here. So I'd like to start by having the folks back in this area be Anne, talk to each other about that. The folks up in these first few pews up here to be Jacob. The folks right in kind of the middle here to be Samira from Nigeria on that. The folks right up in the front here to be John, kind of in the middle over here to be Ingrid. And then the folks in the back area that you would gather together and be Sarah, the fiance there. We'll have you just talk to each, if you can turn to face each other, talk as much. Some of you have copies of the case study with you. You can refer to that. Go for about 10 minutes and really try to understand in depth that perspective so that you can then name one of you as a figure to come up and talk about it. If you get stuck with your version and have some questions, call me over and I'm happy to talk with you about it. You would take a couple more minutes and then find one person for your group who's willing to be the initial member of our circle here. You'll all have a chance to rotate in and out with somebody who's willing to be the initial person. So if I could invite forward Sarah, Ingrid, John, Greg, Samira, Jacob, and Anne. And I'll have you sit.
Who are you?
Who are you?
I'm Sarah.
Do we have a Jacob? We have a Jacob? Okay. This is the chair set aside for Jacob here. So how many of you have participated in the fishbowl exercise like this before? Right. Some of you have. So we've got each of the main characters here. You'll notice there's also an extra chair on either side, and that's to invite other people forward to come in. So I'm going to ask these folks to stay in character for much of the conversation initially, so we get the different viewpoints represented. But if you have something you want to bring up as well as part of the conversation, once we've heard from everybody initially, feel free to come up and occupy one of the other seats. These folks can also move back. Other people can come up. We'll just get the conversation started, get as many viewpoints out there as possible. I think because we're in a big room, I'm going to pass the mic to each person here. So we'll get started here. Oh boy, folks, I'm really glad you joined me for pizza tonight because I am really wrestling with this problem and I have no idea what I'm going to say at the ISA panel coming up next week. I've been studying these issues a lot in my classes, so I think I have a pretty good sense about the structural issues, but they also want me to speak personally, and that's really hard. My fiance Sarah and I haven't really talked about this that much, and this is prompting us to think about the issues, and it's bringing up some really uncomfortable topics that we have to think about, but it's so important that we connect our personal response to understanding the policy and structural issues. So I'd love to hear from each of you what you might have to contribute. And I think it's probably best if I start with my fiance. So I will hand the microphone to Sarah to tell us what we've been talking about with your views on this issue.
So Greg, I know yesterday we talked about the fact that you're really thinking about limiting family size to just one child. And really, I'm not okay with that. I just feel like both of us have experienced larger families, and we've gotten so much from our siblings that I think it's really important for kids to have siblings. And I think that we can actually kind of address this issue of, you know, our impacts through the way that we live our lives, the way that we teach our children, you know, to have less consumption, more environmental ethics as they grow up. And I think we can do things like driving less or recycling or using solar powers, electric cars. I just think we can reduce consumption but still have more children and offer them that fuller life instead of just restricting family size to one.
Sarah, I really appreciate that, and one of the things I love about you and look forward to starting a family with you is because we share those basic commitments to living simply so that other people might simply live. But I'm also aware that we're embedded in a really affluent society where even our individual choices may not make a difference in the levels of consumption. There's so many difficult things just the way our society is structured. So I understand that, and I really appreciate that commitment, but I worry about bringing more children into a society that already is one of the most affluent and consuming in the world on that. But, you know, we're also people of faith, and that's why I really wanted to have Ingrid talk to us about her concerns about religion.
Greg, when you address this group, if you don't take on the ways in which religion has undergirded the systems that concerned you and led people to desire more and more to be fruitful and multiply, I think you will be missing one of the key points. You have to take that part on. And just as you look around the world, every religion tradition I know encourages somewhere in its history and many times in its actual practice today, depending on the particular economic situation, really is part of the culture that undergirds overpopulation. And you have got to take that on. It's clear that certain of the most religious parts of our own country, Utah, for example, there's a higher birth rate. We personally knew people. Some people in the evangelical movement are taking on what has been seen as more traditionally Catholic positions of disavowing any form of artificial birth control, for example. And this is that's growing, that's getting bigger among the people who support many aspects of our capitalistic overconsumptive system. Now, I've heard that there are some little pockets of certain parts of the Lutheranism and Catholicism, so that where there's a beginning of a resistance movement within religion. So maybe it's not religion per se, but we need to encourage that movement and really fight the kind of religion that encourages overpopulation.
I really appreciate that, Ingrid. And I have to say, as somebody who grew up Catholic, I'm so encouraged by the current Pope and what he said about the poor and about the environment, but he's been conspicuously silent on the issues of birth control and population, which really concerns me because he's so progressive, and there are over 1 billion Catholics on the world. The Muslim nation world is growing rapidly, and it's such a delicate topic, but I think you're right, we have to address it. I was really so happy, John, that you were going to be here, because I know you growing up in Africa and Burkina Faso gave you a different perspective on some of these issues, and I'd love to hear what you have to say.
Addressing first the sort of ideal in family and the values of many, having many siblings in a big family that Sarah spoke of. I think the one thing that, in growing up in Africa, that I've realized in looking at what's going on in Nigeria, and that's not well understood by much or appreciated by much of the developed world, is how the population of Nigeria is exploding. And it represents there, as well as in a lot of other places, that the biggest population growth that's going to happen over the next few years is happening in the less developed world. And a lot of that is because the women there are not educated and they have really no other options. And so what you end up is a situation where you have children closer together, you have multiple children, because women have no other option. They have there's pressures come from both sides, certainly from religion. And the problem with addressing it from a religious standpoint is people really view that as an attack on their culture. Coming in from the United States and saying your religion shouldn't teach you this. Both resistance within our country, but certainly within another culture, to tell them that they should have fewer children. Whereas educating women, bringing the idea up from below in terms of how lives could be different and how their lives could be different, would be the key to solving this problem, or one of the most effective ways, as opposed to trying to educate them from the top down.
No, I really appreciate that. And particularly, I want to talk with Samira here, because I think, Samira, both you and I were really offended by that letter that showed up in the newspaper that kind of pointed its finger at poor nations as being the problem. And yet, they do have really fast-growing population rates. And so, how do you respond to these charges that these really, in your home country, Nigeria, 4.5%, 5% population growth, high fertility rates. I mean, how do you respond to these charges?
Well, you have to keep in mind that in Nigeria, agriculture is still a huge, huge part of our economy. And frankly, I think the people in my country are tired of white people telling us that that's the problem, having large families. It's a big part of who we are and the family structure. It's about poverty and it's about hunger. And until we address those two areas, we're going to continue to have a problem. I mean, frankly, I can have 32 kids and they'll consume as much as your one child that you're contemplating having because of the consumption levels in Nigeria. It's just a very different calculus when you look at it that way. And so until...
Please don't have 32 children.
I'll think about that, yeah. And John, your points about education of women, absolutely. And it's about better health care and giving women options and educating young women. That's why I'm able to be here at all in the United States studying, because of that. So I feel strongly that that's the case. But it really is about poverty and coming up with solutions. When America comes and takes all of our oil at a fraction of the cost of what it's really valued at, that continues to hurt our country in ways that we need to find better solutions and try to find ways to be advocates with my country rather than saviors who are going to come in and tell us what to do. It has to be a local solution, and in Nigeria, that's what we're looking for.
No, I really appreciate that. And Jacob, I was so struck because we've been talking a lot about population growth rates in poor countries that don't seem sustainable. But you seem to think that's a misdirected view, that we should be looking elsewhere. So I'd love to hear what you think about this issue.
It's not the poor that are consuming. It's us, principally in North America. Europeans consume half of what we consume in energy and goods. So for us in North America, it really means a change in lifestyle, a change in values. And for Americans particularly, we've always given the goals of more. And what we have tells you about who we are. And materialism has truly become our goal. Whether we want to commit to saying that and live up to a value system that does not say materialism is our goal in life, that's going to be a big change for our culture. But we've got to do it. because we have seen what consumerism is doing to our world, to our values, to us as a people. We've got to do it. It's about consumerism and materialistic values.
But do you really think we can make America great again without without economic growth? And we have a lot of parts of our society that are really in despair because manufacturing has left, the economy has tanked, people don't feel secure in their jobs. And I don't know. I mean, is economic growth the problem, or how can we resolve this without continued economic growth and the consumption that drives that growth?
Consumption comes in many forms. It does not have to be a bigger house, a car that uses more gasoline. The most recent whatever value has been put on fashion or color or the appearance of life. Economic growth can happen also right along beside having a value system that says we need to preserve the beauty, the reality, the health of our nation, because that's going to influence everybody else in the world. So it's not that we're just doing this for us. We are doing it for the betterment of all.
That's very powerful, and I know that the role of technology is going to be critical in this. And due to the wonders of technology, my sister Anne is Skyping into the pizza parlor from Beijing, where she is doing her PhD work on economic development and these very same issues. So, Anne, I don't know what if you have anything that you would, a perspective you could share with us that would shed light on this.
So it's interesting. I think a common thread in this panel has been the issue of poverty, but then also, Jacob, you just mentioned overconsumption. And I think in my studies, I've come to see that it might not be an issue just of overconsumption and poverty per se, but an underlying economic issue that can be solved if we factor in the externalities right now of our environmental degradation. Right now, most of our environmental degradation is not being accounted for in our economic system and in our financial plans. And the worst emitters are the rich ones, are the first world nations. And what many economists are seeing as a solution is a carbon tax, at least for the problem of emissions. This would more properly adjust our consumption levels in the same way that perhaps a cigarette tax might. And it would be holding the largest emitters accountable, the largest consumers accountable. So I've really, in my studies, been seeing this as a very compelling solution.
But do you see that as politically realistic at all? I mean, the current administration has just repealed the Clean Power Plan, has just withdrawn the United States from the Paris Accords. And meanwhile is agreeing with you that we need more economic growth, but he's not talking about economic growth in places like China. He's talking about economic growth here at home to make us great again. I mean, how do we begin to resolve these issues in our current climate? And I chose this pizza parlor because while we can have a nice conversation among our table, there's lots of other people here eating pizza. And I wonder if any of them have perspectives or questions for us on these really difficult
issues.
Or
leftover pizza.
Or leftover pizza. We're hungry. Or if anybody on the panel wants to address anybody else's perspective on the panel here. Here comes a hungry patron.
I want to say this. I'm aware that part of the problem in Africa, as far as overpopulation, is that men and husbands have the say. If they tell the woman that he's going to have sex, they're going to have sex. And I think this is part, you're talking about education is one thing, but empowerment, I don't know how we're going to do it. We do have to work through the men, because a lot of times the women, and I'm sure it's other places too, they pay the price for this because they don't have the final say. That's all I want to say.
Well, fortunately, we do have a woman from Africa on the panel. Samira, I wonder if you could address that issue.
Change comes slow, but... The empowerment of women is, I totally agree with you. I think that's very significant, and that's a cultural shift that we're going to have to figure out how to do. And I do think working through the tribal elders and the men in our society, it's not something that can't be done. I think we need to start. And it is happening in pockets, I think. And in Nigeria, I think that's something that, we need to take that on and take that on very seriously, along with the education of young girls. Because I think as the young girls are educated, and like myself, and get to see things differently because of my education, we can then go back to our countries and make for that change.
It sounds like Ingrid would like to weigh in here.
Yes, we should also notice the current attacks on the freedom of women to... of the kind of women whose children will consume 32 times as much, women like our daughters in the United States, where their opportunity and freedom to control their own, the size of their own families, that reproductive health care they receive, is very much under attack. So while I really completely value that other side of the world and what's happening, I think all these new little consumers who might be born because of health care cuts and other things that our own society are worth thinking about.
It just reminds me that the personal and the political are so deeply interwoven, and even the personal choices we may or may not have are dependent in large part by the policies being put in place in any particular place and the cultural traditions, religious traditions. And any other pizza dwellers out there that...
In Austin, through a Sunday school class on the need for water in Ethiopia, a businessman came up with the idea of Water to Thrive, to bringing wells to Ethiopia. But what happened then is, since he had a business plan, he did go over and has started many, helped build many wells. And one of the things that he did, I think, was very important in empowering women. He required that any community who had a well would have a group of six people. Four of them would be men, and two would be women who would manage this well locally, so that they wouldn't just come and build a well, but there would be a group that would manage this well. So it would be important to do that. Now, one of the things that we heard when we were there was that some of the men were upset because now the women who were always carrying the water, they said, well, what are the women going to do? Now, that wasn't... all the time, but there were men who were saying that. But I think that was an important thing of empowering women to be involved in a local thing, a decision on managing water, which is extremely important in Ethiopia or anywhere in the world. Just a beautiful example.
That is a wonderful example, and I think a reminder to us, too, that worldwide, 4 out of every 5 farmers are women. That we have sometimes, so women are really the ones who are feeding the world, but oftentimes under very difficult circumstances, and freeing them up from things like having to walk for miles just to get water can be a really important part of empowering them as well. Anyone else on the panel or anybody else out there want to weigh in here?
I just recently was talking to a couple who are in Guatemala, and their primary mission with the Presbyterian Church is educating women about domestic violence and sexual abuse. But a big part of what they do is educating the men. So along with educating girls and women, we have to educate men to respect women and not to feel threatened. I know they said they have a micro lending program going, and one of the rules is that the men cannot have control of the money. The women cannot, they have to try the best they can, I suppose, to hang on to the money.
That's a really important point. I mean, they have shown time and time again with micro lending that If women control the money, it benefits the family. If the men control the money, it tends to go outside the family. Either oftentimes there's high rates of alcoholism, other issues than that, but it's a big challenge. So empowering women to actually be decision makers is a huge part of it. Anybody else on the panel want to add anything? We got Michelle.
There's a group of nurses out of the Chicago area, and they all have an association back to Yale. And in Austin, one of those nurses is involved. And they go into a third world country in South America every year, and they spend their vacation there during Women and Children's Health Weeks. And as part of the woman's health review, they give her the option. And there are donated birth control that they're good for 3 years, and our government puts a 1 year limitation on it, and they give these women the opportunity to make a decision about what size family they want to have. And these women know that it'll be a year before they can reverse that decision. But many, many of these women then have the choice without their husbands knowing, without their income stream clients knowing whether they're using any kind of contraception or not.
Well, I want to take this. Oh, there's a hand over here. Yeah.
I'll be really brief. I think there's another part to this where it's not just, and I love all the, how you've constructed this. It's wonderful. But there are also big questions in our time that, and I think especially generations are raising. And I think one of the questions that millennials, I've got sons who are all in their 30s, and a basic question is, what are people for? You know, and we need to understand those questions and address them and reach people in their hearts so that we can be inspired, you know.
That's a really important point, and I think I had a theologian friend, some of you may know John Cobb, who always made the point that people have to have a vision to live towards, can't just be told what's wrong with everything. And that, I think, is one of the really important possibilities of our faith traditions, is to be able to articulate a vision that we're moving toward that can help us take these issues seriously but not leave us in despair. My job is just to leave you in despair. But, no, it is part of just to lay the problem out there, but we also are beginning to work on solutions a little bit. And that's what I want to move to the next section of our talk here. I want to first thank our panelists here. I think you would agree with me, with such articulate young people, our future is in good hands. And In Earth Ethics, I had most of you read the case itself. I also put copies, a few copies in the library, of the commentary that goes with it. Each case in here is paired with a commentary with analysis. And that's the part I want to just go through with you a little bit now, to kind of deepen our understanding of these issues and how we can begin to think about them. Let me see if I can pull this forward. I don't know if this cord is long enough. It's kind of wrapped around that leg there. Let's do it right there. Should be fine. Okay, so then in the commentary, there's two concepts that are really important to begin to understand about both the difficulty and also the promise and possibility of how we talk about this here. And I owe this in particular to my friend Jim Martin Schramm. Many of you may know Jim from his time he spent at Holden here. Jim has studied population and consumption issues extensively. One of these is called the demographic transition model. And it's really important to understand a little bit about this in terms of how we move societies to sustainable levels of population growth. Historically, almost all societies were up here. That is, they had high death rates and high birth rates. So we had a lot of children, but few of those children, oh yeah, if that's in the way, move that out of the way there. A lot of those children didn't survive. And so population growth was relatively slow if not stable, in that area there. Then what began to happen, and this is a good thing, but it had unintended consequences, with better nutrition, better hygiene, more productive agriculture, what we began to see was the death rate in some societies, particularly developing societies, began to fall. But while it was falling, birth rates initially stayed high. So you have this whole area in here where the birth rates are just staying high, death rates are then, so more and more people are surviving. And they, so population began to go quite a bit. My own family is a really good example of this. If you look at what happened in the United States, throughout the 20th century, death rates began to fall dramatically. We had access to antibiotics, better hygiene, all sorts of things. But I'm one of seven children, part of the baby boom thing. Our family, our birth rate stayed high. If you look at what happened to those kids in our family, not one of them has more than two children today. That is, we've now moved to a situation where the death rate has remained low, the birth rate is falling, so we're moving into a more stable time here in terms of our population. And that's happened particularly in Europe, it's happened in Japan, it's happened in most of the developed nations of the world. We'll talk about the United States as a bit of an exception, we'll talk about why. But what that means is during that demographic transition, population continues to grow quite dramatically through this part here, this graph here, until it can begin to level off there. And so most of the developed world, population levels have leveled out pretty well. The big challenge is this demographic transition has not happened in much of the two-thirds world, where death rates are still relatively high, and even where they're falling, birth rates remain high. And so the argument that a key factor in solving population is addressing poverty is part of this, because families in poor nations have large families or numbers of children in order to have some social security, both for agriculture and for ways to take care of children when they or elderly people when they get parents when they get older. So until you begin to address those population or those poverty issues, you keep societies frozen in this place here where the death rate's declining, birth rate remains high, and that keeps population growth growing pretty rapidly. So this is, again, where that's sort of happening here. And just to give you a sense about, here are five different places along that graph where we can see countries here. Interestingly enough, there are only a few remote places in the world anymore where both the death rate and the birth rate are very high. You might see, for example, indigenous groups in the Amazon, places like that. And their population is relatively stable. They have a lot of children, but few of those children survive. Most poor nations are in what is called the early expanding place here. Their death rate is beginning to fall, but their birth rate remains high. So they list here Egypt, Kenya, India as good examples of that. Improving conditions are bringing the death rate down. Cultural factors and poverty are keeping the birth rate high. And so the death rate's falling rapidly, but we're seeing a very rapid increase in population in those countries here. Lots of different reasons. They list the reasons here. Many children are needed for farming. Many children die at an early age. Religious and social encouragement, lack of family planning or lack of access to contraception. Lots of different issues in that area there. And then they have here reasons for change in the death rate, improvements in medical care, water supply, sanitation. Fewer children are dying. If you move over here, you have a whole other group that they call the late expanding group, where the death rate is getting much lower, but the population, the birth rate is also starting to fall. So a country like Brazil is characteristic of this. Brazil is in that transition from being a poor nation to a rapidly developing nation. Much of its society, the birth rate has come way down, but there's still rural pockets and things that keep it there. And so the birth rate's falling, but the death rate is falling more so. So there's still an increase in population, but the increase is happening more slowly. So they're moving through that transition. Then you have a situation here where both the death rate and the birth rate have fallen down and they're approaching each other here. And so you're moving into a place of population stability again. So here there is the United States, Japan, France, the UK, where the birth rate is low, the death rate is low, and so population is stable or only slowly increasing here. Reasons are good family planning, good health, improving status of women, later marriages. One of the key things about educating women, they tend to marry much later. If women marry later, they tend to have smaller families. And then we see that particularly in this country here. Interestingly enough, we actually now have several countries that have moved into a declining population factor here, where the birth rate is actually lower than the death rate. So they're not replacing themselves at a rate there. Germany is a good example of this. Much of the former Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, Russia has a declining birth rate. These countries tend to compensate for that sometimes by having higher immigration rates. But there are several places there, and so population is actually decreasing in some of those places, which has good environmental impacts, but a big concern for economic impact, particularly because increasingly what you're going to see are countries that are aging, where their older population is larger than their younger population. So as the older population moves into retirement and wants to retire, they need to be supported, things like Social Security, by a decreasing smaller working population. So big concerns on that. But that's kind of a snapshot view of what's happening globally. And let's just see if there's any hands or things I can clarify here. Pardon? So China is actually, I'm going to bring that up. China is kind of in Brazil moving over to here. And we'll take a look at it because China and India right now are the two most populous nations in the world. They're on two pretty different trajectories. And I'll talk about that in a moment here. Hand back here. See what I think. Does this make sense to people, or is there places I've confused you about it? The thing is that the actual population is this color here. So anything that's between this line and that line. So when birth rates and death rates are high, small population. As birth rate stays high, death rate falls, the population really begins to grow. So this is the population graph here. And what we want to do is to get it stabilized or begin to decline there. So that's part of the challenge we're looking at here. Just to give you a little bit of sense about how this happens. So that's the demographic transition. And we want to see countries move through that demographic transition. We'd ideally like countries to reach a point of low birth rates and low death rates. So people who survive have a good quality of living. One of the other challenges is something called demographic momentum. And here it's a little paradoxical at first, but even when birth rates begin to decline, as they are worldwide, some countries will still have rapid population growth because of their age structure. So here you see two very different age structures, Italy on the right, Uganda on the left. Italy, this is hard to see these numbers, but this is 0 to 4, 1, you know, 5 to 9, 10 to 14, so 20 to 24. So this lower part here are children and people moving into their early reproductive years there. If you notice, that part of the population is pretty similar to the older part of the population in Italy. So as these folks have one or two children, this sector of the population will be dying off, and they'll be essentially replacing it there. In Uganda, in contrast, the vast majority of the population is under the age of 15 or 20. So the older population would have had 10 or 12 children, but there are far fewer of them. Even if these folks here only have three children, quite a few less than their parents, because there's so many, population will continue to grow rapidly for a while. And so part of the shift here is the demographic transition is going to have to go through a period of time to move this kind of structure of the age population to a more vertically oriented one here. And we are beginning to see some of that happen. I'll give you, the next slide shows you a good example of this. 30 years ago, Thailand had an age structure, much of Southeast Asia had an age structure very typical. Uganda's on the right. Look at Thailand today. Thailand now has a much, much smaller population of its young people in relative to its older people than a place like Uganda. So if you were to go to Southeast Asia, some of these countries have really changed their age structure here, largely through economic development. We see over and over again as countries get economic security, family, and as they begin to urbanize, as they move away from agricultural, family sizes decrease. Now, one thing to be aware of here, the human species, Homo sapiens, since the time it began, has been a rural-based group here. Almost all human beings have lived in rural societies, either in hunter-gatherer societies or more recently in agrarian societies. That's changed in the last decade. Somewhere in the decade of 2000, 2010, we moved through a transition where now the majority of the world's population lives in urban settings. And that's only going to continue to grow. Increasingly, people live in urban settings. One of the things we know in urban settings is people have smaller families, because in an urban setting, lots of children become an economic burden, not an economic asset, as they are in agrarian societies. So part of what we're seeing is urbanization, and part of what we're seeing is growing economic development. But they're both leading to smaller family sizes, which is a positive trend for us when we start thinking about these issues. Make sense so far? Okay, so
will that Thailand graph just continue if there, all things being equal?
It's a really good question. Will the Thailand graph continue, all things being equal here? Probably. But I'll show you some other interesting trends, because the interesting thing right now is that China has stabilized its population largely because for 30 or 40 years they've had this controversial one-child population. China relatively soon will begin to have a declining population. It kind of blows our mind because we associate China with huge numbers, which it has, and it used to have rapid population growth. But they've been so successful in their policy that they're actually going to probably begin to decline. Now, this is a graph here that is it may be a little difficult to sort of see here, but this is 1950. Here we are here, 2015 or so. So we're right about this part of the graph here, and it stretches out to 2050. What this shows is three different scenarios for population, and here's where the small numbers really begin to add up. If you reduce fertility from 4 to 2.5 or 4 to 3, you're going to be very different notions on here. So these are the world population estimates based on whether or not we're successful in helping poor nations develop, get economic security, helping girls to get educated, helping women to have access to birth control. All these different factors will make a huge difference. If we're successful, some people say the population will begin to level off around 8 billion by 2050. Most people I know think that's overly optimistic. We aren't going to meet that chance. Probably median one in there is this, and I'm really bad with color. What's the middle color? Is that purple or blue? Anyway, whatever color that line is in the middle there. And that's living in about 9 billion. Most of the most hopeful lessons is that we can maybe stabilize the population towards 9 billion. But there are other possibilities where it just continues to grow and we reach over 10 billion by 2050. Some people say we could be to 14 to 16 billion by the end of the century. And one of the real challenges right now, as I'll get to this moment here, is that climate change is making it more and more difficult to bring good economic development to poor nations. If you can't address poverty, it's going to be very difficult to stabilize population growth. So this is a big challenge, and it's going to bring in that second factor of consumption levels on that, which I'll get to in a moment here. So this just breaks it down by three different, by the most developed, less developed, and least developed nations here. And you can see that this red one here is the most developed nations. And what we see from 1950 to 2050, the affluent nations are pretty much leveling out. So in terms of population growth, that's really good news. The challenge is we haven't leveled out our consumption rates. Our consumption rates continue to grow, and that's the other factor in this, which we'll get to in a moment here. What we're seeing is likely that the less developed regions are beginning, they're moving through this trend, they're also beginning to level. These are the Brazils and the world, the Indias of the world. So if we can continue to help them develop, the Vietnams, the Thailands, good chance they're going to begin to level out. A bigger problem is the least developed regions, which is primarily sub-Saharan Africa and parts of the Arab-speaking world, places like Afghanistan, Iraq, things like that. There, they are still on a pretty much upward trajectory without showing much sign of leveling in the short term. And so you combine all those together to get overall population trends on that. I don't even know if this slide, can people even read any of these things in the back there? Pretty faint, but just to give you a sense about it here. On the left side, these are the folks in the countries that haven't gone through that demographic transition, or where they're incomplete, they talk about incomplete fertility transition. But you begin to see the difference that changes in fertility can make here. The numbers are getting better. We want to get people numbers down to about 2.1. 30 years ago, these numbers were all above 6. So the numbers are getting better. They're all between 2.7, you know, in some places 4.5 and stuff. But because of what I talk about, that demographic momentum, they're going to continue to grow. So Afghanistan, 24 million people in 2005, by 2050, probably 74 million, almost a tripling in size. And think about all the problems Afghanistan is experiencing here. Angola, 16.5 million, up to 42 million right there. You see Somalia, 8.5 million up to 24 million. Yemen, 21 million to 44 million. One of the things these countries also have in common is many of these countries have ongoing civil strife. The ongoing civil strife creates constant economic insecurity. It makes economic development virtually impossible. And as a result, populations continue to grow. It's paradoxical because populations are dying because of the war, but the population growth is outstripping them. So unless we're able to bring economic security to some of these places, look at a country like Ethiopia, estimated to be 175 million or so by 2050. So these are really some of the biggest challenging areas. And notice, most of these are sub-Saharan Africa or in the Middle East, where there's a lot of strife on that here. Look at this one here, China. 1.3 billion 2005. By 2050, only 1.4 billion. China is a population success story and is actually probably beginning to decline. China's replacement rate is 1.5. That's below replacement rate. So it's beginning to level off and will probably begin to decrease. Now that's going to create a lot of problems for China. Think about this. Every young person in China under the age of 15, how many grandparents do they have? 4, right? But those grandparents all only have one grandchild. So that one grandchild, as she or he moves to adulthood, has 4 grandparents that she or he alone may have to support. And my sister Martha and me, when our parents were aging, there were 6 of us kids taking care of them. There are 9 grandchildren in that. So our population is aging. So this China's going to have a real challenge in that. But in terms of population numbers, that's good. China has a 1.1. Bangladesh is actually a modern success story. We've heard a lot of the problems in poverty there. But Bangladesh has actually been able to really bring down its growth rate, and that's a Muslim nation, you know, and so there's something really good there. Nigeria is a real concern. Nigeria has actually gotten to a relatively lower birth rate, but because, again, of that demographic momentum, so much of its population is under the age of 15, Nigeria will probably double to 290 million. Nigeria is the size, I think, of about Texas. I may be wrong on this here. But it's soon going to have a population larger than the United States in a much, much smaller area on that here. Pakistan, similar kind of thing. They brought their fertility rate down, but it's estimated to go from 165 billion to 335 billion, which is about a little more than the population of the United States. This group of countries over here is really interesting. These are the countries, you notice all their population rates are below 1. They're projected to decline. So some of Russia, projected to go from 143 million to 116 million. Japan, 127 million, 101 million. Italy, a Roman Catholic country, but a low birth rate, just relatively stabilized from 58 million to 57 million. And you see Korea, Germany, Hungary. These are going to be really big challenging countries in terms of their economics, because we don't yet know how to take care of our elderly without a growing population of the youth. I mean, in some ways, you may have heard this, Social Security system, in some ways in this country, is a bit of a Ponzi scheme, right? You all think you've been paying into Social Security and the money you paid in is going to be there to support you when you retire. Actually, it's the money that the young people are paying in today that's supporting our elderly people. And this is why there's so much concern about Social Security, because as that young people group shrinks and baby boomers and millennials move to retirement, there's less and less money to support that. We're going to hit that much later than these countries are. And so some of these countries are economically really well off. Italy, Japan, Korea, and so forth. Some of them are pretty poor. Estonia, Belarus, you know, Ukraine and Russia, Romania. Question here.
In addition to the financial support that we have from the young people to the burgeoning old people, we need the physical support that will not be there as life is longer.
Yep.
80 to 100 years old becomes more common, and the dementia and health problems that demand personal physical services from younger people.
Yeah, it's really amazing. My husband's father is 91, his mother is 86. They are both great health. They're both living independently. They're both traveling. And they expect they may well do that another 5 or 10 years. We hope they do. But our whole older population is shifting and getting older there. But the other thing is about 80% of our total health care bill is spent in the last 2 years of a person's life. You know, and so these are big issues. So just want to look at that, some of these things here. So there's other things we can look at, but just to give you a sense, part of the challenge is different countries are going to have different challenges around population. Now, and this one, I won't spend too much time here, but you can see some of this. And again, I hope that's easier for you to see than it is for me. I'm really bad with color. But you can see the births for women, 4.4 minus 5 or more, are disproportionately in Africa and this part of Asia here. The places gone less than that are, you can see North America, increasingly South America, which used to have very high population rates because it's Roman Catholic. South America is largely stabilizing. Really interesting as they get economic stability on that. So there are going to be some big challenges in that. That's population. I want to move now in the last 10 minutes here to looking at consumption here. Well, all right, one thing I want to talk about here. This is a really interesting one because the main reason the United States has not stabilized our population growth is not because of our birth rates, it's because of immigration. The numbers of immigrants income, and this is a really difficult topic for us to talk about here, but our population is growing primarily because we're adding immigrants, both legal and undocumented workers on that. And this just begins to show you that the difference that these numbers can make. If we move towards zero annual immigration, not having any immigration there, our population is estimated to decline. And this is to the year 2200. We would stabilize initially, but we would continue to decline. If we keep our population at 500,000 annual immigration, it looks like we'll have just a steady but a relatively linear growth. But if we keep immigration at 1 million, 1.5 million, or 2 million, we begin to see some really, really large numbers. Now again, this is by 2200, so this is a century and a half away. But by then, we could be over 1 billion people in the United States here on that. So when we look at population, we have to look at both birth rate and immigration because it's the total numbers that begin to add up. And this is why immigration is really a challenging issue to think about what's the compassionate response, but also how do we think about consumption levels on that. So there are many thoughtful people who oppose immigration in the United States, not because they're not compassionate towards immigrants, but because we consume so much in the society. And when we add more people here, we add to that consumption level on the planet. So that's the next thing I want to just take a quick look at here. We can move past that. Oh, but this is just an interesting one, just last thing here. Notice what's happening with China. China's projected to peak its population within the next 5 or 10 years and then begin to decrease rapidly to 2100 to be down lower than 1.2, by 1.1 billion. In contrast, look to Nigeria. If Nigeria continues the way it is, and Nigeria is a much smaller country, by the end of the century, Nigeria is projected to have a population almost as much as China's. Over a billion people in that area. So United States will likely to continue to grow moderately, but still be up in this over 400 million, close to 500 million people by the end of the plan. We're currently about 320, 325 million, somewhere in there. India, in the next decade, will pass China as the world's population. It will largely stabilize, but it's going to stabilize at 1.6 billion people there. So these trends are what people, demographers, are trying to look at here. Now, if you can hang in with me for another 5 or 10 minutes, I want to just get to the other issue that we talked about, which is consumption. Because this consumption is the other issue that's really driving environmental problems and driving climate change. the world's poorest 20%, all those poor countries with high population rates, they consume only 1.5% of the world's total goods. So in terms of consumption that has direct impact on environmental issues, the problem is not poor countries. The world's middle 60%, the large, three-fifths of the world's population, only consumes a little over 20% of the resources. The elephant in the room is the world's richest 20%. Us, Europe, Japan, and so forth, consumes over 3/4 of all the world's resources. So even though we've stabilized our population, our consumption rates are what are driving the majority of the world's environmental problems. Yeah?
Do you know how much of that is the United States?
I'm going to get to that. It's a really good question on that here. So this raises this interesting notion of what we call ecological debt. What this means is every region has a biological carrying capacity. You can only support a certain number of deer. You can only support a certain number of people until you begin to strip your ability to sustain yourself. The reason wealthy nations have been able to sustain themselves here is not because we're doing it through local sustainability. We are borrowing or stealing the ecological sustainability from other nations. Right? So I'll see if I can explain this here. This shows here Europe and the United States as having excess consumption. Where's that coming from? We're importing a lot of natural resources and other things from other nations. Their agriculture, their mineral resources, all of that. That's sustaining us. But it's doing two things that are really problematic. One is we're really over-consuming for what the planet can consume. And secondly, we're depriving these poor nations of what they're going to need to meet their own needs on that here. And so this notion of ecological debt can help us to understand what's going on globally with levels of consumption. Folks who studied this say 1987 was a really critical year. Up until 1987, the total global population was still living within the carrying capacity or the ecological capacity of the planet to sustain it. Since 1987, we've been what they call overshoot. The whole total global population is consuming more than the planet can sustain. So how does that show up? Where do we see this showing up? What are some symptoms of this? Think about global fisheries. What's happened to fish stocks in the world? They're plummeting. Think about global forests. Deforestation is rapidly increasing. All these different things we take for granted as clean water is disappearing. All what some people call ecosystem services, the things we depend on ecosystems to be able to survive, are crashing. Biodiversity is crashing. We're in the sixth great extinction. We're driving other members of our planet experiencing this before humans are. But they're going extinct. So this is a really critical problem. We're in the situation of global ecological debt. But that global ecological debt is not spread equally. It's the wealthy nations that are driving it here. So someone asked about the United States here. You begin to see here, I don't know if you can see this here, but this color here is where our footprint is over 50% larger than our capacity to sustain itself there. Note this one here, the green ones here, are countries that are actually living within their biological capacity. So this is really interesting. South America, much of Africa, even though they're much poorer than us, they're living within the ability of their continents to support themselves. Canada is. Not that Canada doesn't consume a lot, but Canada's population is 1/10 of the United States, and it's a larger country. But you look at countries like the United States and Mexico, all of Europe, China and India, they are living beyond the ability of their local places to sustain themselves. How are they doing it? Well, this is one of the places I teach an entire class where I am called Globalization, Justice, and the Environment. And the global economy is facilitating this ongoing transfer of resources from the poor areas to wealthy places that support our lifestyles. But it really raises a question of justice. This is a just situation in terms of both the planet itself can't support it, but we're also depleting the places that are going to most need it. So people raise the question about how is this distributed here? By far the most out of whack in the country, in the world, is North America, right? So North America, this just shows the number of Earths, the number of planets we would need if the whole world lived at the same level that we do. We need 5 planets, right? Now, what's challenging about this, and again, I really apologize for being a bearer of bad news, but what is U.S. foreign policy based on? What's our economic development based on? It's based on making the rest of the planet live like us. And I don't want to belittle this. I think our political freedoms, our way of life, are admirable. I want the rest of the planet to have that. But we're also exporting the American lifestyle. And we would need 5 planets if everybody on the world lived in them. Europe is much better. They'd have roughly half the impact that we do, but you still need almost 3 planets for Europe. In fact, notice this, even Latin America, since living largely within its capacity, if you did that globally, you still need 2 planets there. Only the Asian Pacific and African nations are living below that. So this is the real dilemma. How do we help those nations get out of really dire poverty without exceeding the ecological capacity? And it's a real challenge. We're trying to, how do we do economic development with ecological sustainability, I think is the challenge for our age here. This just shows you kind of how many Earths do we need if the world's population lived. Australia is actually a little worse than us. They have a lot less people. But you can see the United States, roughly 5 planets, Switzerland and Korea, 3.3, even Russia would have that problem there. So this frames it. This is the problem of consumption. Yeah.
One of the other slides